of October 2005, and this is student Louise Farquharson interviewing native elder Del Hayward at number 5, Walsh Hall. So I think we're going to carry on talking about potlatches, but probably kind of talk around the subject quite a bit as well. I mean, first of all, I was having a look at this book, like I was talking about, called Mission to Metlakatla, and I found it really interesting. It's basically about Father Duncan taking up the Tsimshian people to Alaska from Canada, and I just kind of found it quite astonishing, like how some of the, like, it describes potlatches within this book in a kind of really demeaning way, like describing one of the celebrations. It was, open quote, splattered with blood, and the hysterical cannibals danced and leapt by the firelight, filling even their own people with terror. I was kind of surprised at like how they managed to portray like some of the potlatches as like really kind of almost just not in the same way as I've kind of been imagining them, like it's like, mm-hmm. kind of like more joyful kind of celebrations. And I just wondered if, I mean, there were times when there were potlatches which were kind of like more based on kind of more aggressive mm-hmm. situations, or whether this was just a drastic exaggeration.
Yeah, this is probably prior to the missionaries getting there, and they probably did a lot of research on that and found, you know, that to be true. Because I heard stories that the Tsimshian people were feared for that. You know, all the other the Haidas and the other Tsimshian people that were down there, and they were afraid of the Tsimshian people because of their, their aboriginal ways, I guess. And it's probably why Duncan was there to try to convert them over. And see, he did a good job. But I guess socially, you know, like there was a lot of competition going on between, you know, the different tribes on the Clintus, Haidas, and Tsimshian. You know, they fought each other all the time. I remember hearing about the breakdown of the, how the social structure of like the Tlingit people. In fact, was, I kind of learned it when I was, I don't know if you were there when I told the story about when my dad and I were walking on the shore, with, you know, a whole bunch of us going up to this, when we were heading out to the Aleutian Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped there, we were stormbound in Buna for a long time. Turned out that was my dad spent a lot of his childhood there. My grandfather married, it wasn't the other one around, I don't remember now, but one of my grandparents married a Clinton, and they lived up there during my dad's childhood. And he said I found out later that he and his dad rode all the way back down to Metlakatla on a boat, you know, a skiff.
Mm.
And you row and you sail as well. It's just an open skiff, you know. That's over 300 miles.
Gosh.
And it took them, they said it took them a month. They just took their time on stopping different villages and towns along the way.
So that was your grandfather?
Well, yeah, that was my grandfather, and my dad did that. And that was done commonly back then. He said it took about a month.
Mm.
tell on the fishing boat, it's 3 or 4 days.
Gosh. Yeah, it's interesting, like going back to what Cottage used to represent. This other book I've been looking at as well, Sim Tian Culture, A Light Through the Ages by Jay Miller, was talking about how potlatches were used as a form of rivalry between chiefs,
mm-hmm.
like in tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like as a competition of
mm-hmm.
like who had more. Is that true?
Yeah. Like the competition among the captains that I told you the story about, where I mentioned up there at the museum that they bid on this mask, and the guy that won that bid, he was told by a classmate of mine, I don't know when this event took place. It might have been centuries ago, not centuries, but maybe it could have been recently. At that time, back in the 50s, when I was in high school, they bid on the. I don't know if it's practiced today or not, but back then, these classmates that came from that village of Huna. Said that the guy that won the bid paid $30,000 for that mask. But it, like I said, it was a competition. And I don't know, male ego, I guess.
Yeah.
You know. But he commanded a big position in society. The guys looked up to him now. He's considered now because he had all the money to. Because he had the money, because he was a good fisherman, made all that money, tells you that he was a good fisherman, because he made enough money to be able to come up with the cash,
So that was recently?
I would say, I heard the story when I was in high school.
So
back in the 50s,
yeah.
The mid, early 50s. And whether that occurred during that time, I don't know.
Mm.
It could have happened, a generation before. It could have happened that summer. I don't know. But you hear stories like that. It's word of mouth.
Mm.
You don't know. Most of the stories we hear are word of mouth.
Yeah.
That's the way I hear it.
Mm.
And then the only place I really read about things, as far as Father Duncan, was the book that was given to me by my mother-in-law. It was then that I understood a lot of what had happened there. And there's a lot of things that are not talked about anymore. Was never documented, but again, was passed on by word of mouth. They were pretty ugly stories. It's not documented, so nobody says, this is just what I heard. It could have been rumors, it could have been truth,
Of what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy, looking back at this book, to gain a place with Father Duncan to migrate from Canada to Alaska. He only wanted to take people who were who would be happy. I say happy. I don't know who would conform to his new rules.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the basic gist of these rules seems to be kind of giving up the main part of traditional life.
Mm-hmm.
Here, there's this list 1 to 14. The first one being to give up their medicine club work, and the second one to cease calling in the medicine man when ill. So that would be giving up all kind of traditional medicinal practices.
Mm-hmm.
To cease painting their faces, which is a massive part of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And
the other thing is that tattoos. I remember my grandmother having tattoos on her arm. She must have had it all her life, because they might have done that to them when they were kids, little girls. And they were crude looking tattoos. They ran up the whole entire length there from the back of the kind of from the back of this way. And, never discussed them. And or if they, you ask about it, you know, they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just remember it, you know, as a little boy. There was like commonly saw it among the older people back then. They were, you know, like my grandparents.
But they don't talk about it.
No, I never. You know, I hear stories, you know, that, you know, whether they're true or not, I don't know. I don't know why that was done, though. I just remember seeing it. I knew there were tattoos, you know, because they were green looking.
Mm.
And they were just these basic lines that cross things. They must have some, you know, symbolic meaning.
Yeah, so that's not an aspect of culture which has been brought back yet.
I think it is.
It
you know, I think it was something that they did back, you know, for centuries.
But in contemporary society now, like...
And they don't do that now, no.
So that's one aspect that has actually been completely lost.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't know. You know, there's nothing I can verify.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Nobody alive today would know.
Mm.
You know, but, it's hard to get information about that, you know, because there's no written documentation about things other than the people that come in from outside and do writing like this.
Mm.
So they may have gotten second, third, fourth hand information about them. You know, you don't know whether it's true or not.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
wouldn't have any reason not to believe it.
Mm. And I guess with like something like tattoos, I mean, once the person who is tattooed has passed away and passed on, there's nothing left. Whereas with something like totem poles or like this,
yeah,
the spoons that we were looking at, I mean, there's examples left of those and they kind of live on for a longer period of time. But that's interesting. Yeah, that book is kind of strange. It kind of glorifies Father Duncan really massively and kind of, it seems to be, it justifies every move that he makes and every suggestion that
yeah.
he makes.
Well,
and like you said previously, I can understand how it can be looked at in a positive light, i.e. it did give the Tsim Sha people a head start in you know, the modern day culture, but at the same time, I mean, there are a lot of things that he did that it's very difficult to see in a positive light, and that book is really strange in the way that it kind of doesn't seem to falter, and it's kind of like,
yeah,
it's like glorification.
His control of the people that in Middle Kala itself was, you know, like a dictator.
Mm. Yeah.
That's, you know, the only way I could compare it was because he ran the town, he made the rules, but he used a lot of the modern times, you know, they had their policemen, they had the magistrate, and they had the, you know, all those kind of things they have nowadays, you know, the magistrate and the police and the council, and they established a council, and bylaws that govern the council and the town, all the rules that were generated back then, passed and everything. He followed a lot of the guidelines, but then, you know, he was there. I don't know, I look at it like just like if an elder came up to me and told me, you do it this way, and you're not going to argue with him.
Mm.
And that's the kind of well, just like me with my dad now, when he was alive, even the month before he died, I thought I could stand up to him face to face and say, no, I'm not going to, you know, disagree with him. I found out I couldn't because of the way he raised us.
Mm.
So when I came down to visit him, just visit my family down there one time, this last time, the last summer before he died, in August of that summer, 2000. He wanted to talk to me, because I'm the oldest. And he was spreading word around the town. He says, when you see Del, tell him to come down the house.
Mm.
and we got that down there, we got this communication system that works just as well as electronic.
Yeah, mobile phones, cell phones, yeah.
when somebody wants something done, or like especially like my dad, that he's well respected, he sends word out, he'll send out a grandchild, you know, run up to where I'm trying to find me, see?
Yeah.
And I'm visiting along the way, you know, on the way. Eventually I was going to end up at the house. This is the way I normally do it. I was visiting my oldest brother. He lived right close to where I was and was planning to stay with my son. Because whenever I went to my hotel, I stayed with my oldest son. And I would visit my oldest brother, and my second oldest brother, and then my youngest brother, and my family. And by the time, you know, I may start off like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 7, 8 o'clock, he's through with his 3 brothers, and you know, sit around, visit, and eat a little bit, and you know, things like that.
Mm.
And he said, okay, I'm going to go down and see Dad. When I got down there, it was about 9 o'clock in the evening, and I already established with my son I was going to stay with him. And I put all my, you know, my luggage there,
right.
Me and my wife. And arranged what bedroom I was going to have and all that. So when I got down there at 9 o'clock at my dad's place, he says, you're going to stay in this room. And I looked at him and I said, all right.
Okay.
But you see, that's the kind of command adults have over their kids.
Yeah.
You don't argue back. You don't.
A lot of respect.
You just, you know.
Yeah.
But in my dad particularly, because I learned everything from him, and he was always conveying new information to me all the time as I was growing up, you know, and he was a big source of my whatever I learned.
Mm. I've definitely understood that.
I really looked up to him. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the same time, that time, I knew he wanted to talk to me because I was getting winded as I was visiting around. So I kind of knew what he was going to do. Here he was going to tell me. He's hard of hearing.
Mm.
And, because we're around boats, and I am that way. I can't hear women's voices very well, and our kids, you know, very high pitch. And he's really deaf. I mean, he's got all his life listening, you know, being in an environment of motors and, you know, loud noises all his life. And that's true of all the guys down there. And so they get hard of hearing by the time they reach my age, you know. Fish all our life in this really noisy environment. And I had to send up to my son. I had to go up there and get all my luggage and move down to that room.
I bet you didn't
but
have to explain
talk,
much.
But he did talk. He started talking to me in ways he never talked to me as I was growing up. And he started conveying a lot of information. Like he knew he was going to die, he knew, you know, he had much more time left, so he wanted to get this off his chest. And at that time I couldn't talk to him because of his hard of hearing, and I said, well, I got a set of headphones up here in Fairbanks, and I use it out hunting, you know, for hunting moose, so I could hear it better. He said, it works pretty good. I said, I didn't have any hearing aids yet. I did buy a set later, but they broke down and I don't use them anymore.
Mm.
But I use that headset a lot, you know, when I watch TV, and I have to turn the sound up pretty high for me to understand what's being said on the TV. Said, I'll bring that down, and I've got other hearing aids as well. I said, I'll try different things. So, in the meantime, said, this was in August. middle of August, about, I want to go hunting up here in Fairbanks, you know, because moose season is coming up the 1st of September, so I want to get back up there and get ready, you know, and get my boat ready and get out on the fishing, I mean, the hunting ground. So I said, I'll come right back right after. And he died on the 15th of September while I was up there. And somebody from the Mental Village had to come out and out hunting. So normally we leave our, we always tell somebody where we're going to go. Some of the managers on the bank, and we said, could you tell so-and-so that we're going upriver or downriver or whatever river we're going to go to? We always do that. Luckily I did that, you know, they were able to locate me what they threw down. And see, I didn't get a chance to talk to him.
You never found out where he was?
No. And I think he was going to tell me how he wanted his estate to be handled. That's what I was thinking. And he knew that I had the respect of all my brothers and sisters that they would listen to me. And I was going to set up so that I was going to videotape them, just like what we're doing in the class.
Yeah.
So that if there was any dispute, you know, we videotape and say, just what Dad said. I was going to interview him just like you guys are.
So you just had to kind of guess what he wanted.
Yeah. But you know, I already knew what he wanted because, you know, you grow up and you know his way of thinking and everything. You know, so I pretty much had the baseline already. You just said, well, I guess he wanted me to have more of the detail. That's where it ended, and now we're in a conflict between the two families. Right off the bat, we've got a great divergence.
Between the children of the first and second family? No, really?
No, it's held up in probate. It's been held up ever since.
Wow. It seems something I noticed. From I was kind of thinking about how we handle like death in, I don't know, in Western society, well, like back in England. My grandfather died recently this year, and it's strange how we'll take that and we'll quickly try and set up a funeral, and in 2 weeks it's gone and it's done and it's finished, and the funeral is very small, you know, it's quite solemn, there's not any kind of, you know, I mean, like, we reflect a lot on like their lives and kind of like talk positively about what they achieved, but there's no kind of like, I don't know, it's not an event that people enjoy, you know. And it seems like people back in Britain have a much, I mean, like my mum, she's not dealt with it very well, and she can't really talk about his death that easily. But whereas it seems here, I don't know if I've got it right or not, but you seem to be able to talk about, I don't know, your father's death, like, quite, not easily, but you seem to be okay, like you seem to, having a potlatch seems not, having like a potlatch and celebrating in a different way seems to kind of help you deal with it better.
Yeah, it does. It surprised me too, because I've seen it, you know, appear among the Azerbaijan. That's where I became comfortable with it, you know, because I could see the, how can I describe it? You know, like up here, they feed the people. The people that are grieving feed the people that are around to help or express do their feelings about it, and enables them to talk about it right away. It's the first wound, you know, and so they believe up here you gotta keep it up in the flesh and in the memory. And talk about your good times that you had with, you know, the deceased, you know, from both perspective of the siblings and you know, parents, or, and you talk to the survivors a lot, and you visit every day till the burial.
Yeah.
So it may go on for 4 or 5 days, and each of those 4 or 5 days before the burial, you know, they're processing the body for burial, and they're getting all the... See, they build their own coffins up here.
Right, yeah.
And you get people that are assigned to that job, could be relatives, most of the time, brothers and uncles, you know, or the family, or the deceased.
Mm.
And then you'll get two or three guys on that project, and they'll have the women, whatever, and they line the cask, and they get them all lined up with the right equipment and materials and everything.
Yep.
And when the guys get through that cask, they come in and the women line it up, and then they start getting the clothes together and things like that.
Mm. It's a big group effort, you know, I think people like, are brought together by it. And
yeah,
that's
then, but it has a, it makes it easier on the, because they're constantly doing something, you know, the people that are grieving, the immediate family.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if they're helping other people, you know, they feel good. And they feed the people that are come around and be with them, you know, there could be friends or even non-friends, you know, just the fact that they come around makes them feel good and makes them feel better. It makes them the grieving process a lot more bearable.
Yeah, yeah.
And this will go on for several days, right up to the funeral.
Yeah.
And they'll have a potlatch after, and the people, you know, the elders will talk to them, and they'll all cry together and laugh together, you know, they'll review a lot of good times and bad times,
yeah.
You know, so nothing's held back about that person.
Yeah, overall, I mean, is death thought of, do you think it's thought of in a less negative way than
I don't see anything negative about it myself.
Yeah.
Because it, it helps the survivors, it really does.
Yeah.
I was really amazed about that when I first seen it.
Yeah.
Okay.